Dean Lynn Phillips will begin by introducing the George Story Lectureship. Then I'll talk a little bit about Stuart Elman, and then we'll actually get to hear from Stuart Elman, which is what he came for.
Yes, opposed to us. It's a wonderful crowd. Thank you for coming, and welcome to the 2013 George Story Lecture in the Humanities. I'm the Dean of Arts, and I'm very pleased to be here with you this evening. It gave me the chance to actually look a bit into what the George Story Lectureship was about, because I'm a newbie and I didn't know, so thanks for the opportunity. The George Story Lecture was established in 1996 to honor the late Dr. George Story, who was also the Henrietta Harvey Lecture. Well, he was also the Henrietta Harvey Professor of English Language and Literature here at Memorial. He came here in the early 50s and died May 9, 1994, only weeks before he was about to be bestowed the title of Professor Emeritus and also Doctor of Letters, which is, you know, one stage above having a PhD and in recognition of very high achievement in the humanities. George Story had a lifelong interest in Renaissance studies and was Memorial's first public orator. Just such a lovely tradition, that one. It didn't happen at my old university, so I always think that's such a nice feature. He was one of the principal figures to help to develop Newfoundland studies at Memorial and was also a key influence in the community at large, having chaired both the Newfoundland Arts Council and the Newfoundland Heritage Foundation. He received many awards, including the Order of Canada, but perhaps his most lasting achievement was his role as a co-editor, along with Dr. Bill Kerwin and John Widdowson, of one of the province's most iconic publications. We all know what that is, right? Dictionary of Newfoundland English, of course. So on behalf of the Faculty of Arts, I welcome all of you and to what will no doubt be a very entertaining and enlightening lecture on Foucault. And I now ask Dr. Crowden, and this is a wonderful interdisciplinary opportunity here. Here's Dr. Story, who was an English professor, and Dr. Grattan, who is a philosophy professor. And now we have you as a geographer, correct? Yes. So, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you,
Peter.
Thank you. That was a wonderful short history. It's good that we are honoring somebody who had a doctoral in letters, because Stuart just got his.
You did?
This year. And also, he was our public orator, and Stuart will be our public orator tomorrow at the public lecture and jockey club at the Peterson Pub at 5 o'clock. So let me quickly introduce him. I wrote this up, so that's good. So it's a great honor for me to introduce Stuart Elden for this prestigious George Story Lectureship. Just an FYI, the signs have moved the E from Eldon's name, apparently, to the George Story, and the back again. It's gotten very confusing this week. I keep seeing new signs up. But I want to thank Dean Phillips for an excellent welcome for Stuart to our community, and I'm glad she can make it tonight to see some of the thriving work that's going on in philosophy within and beyond our department. And I thank her and her office's diligent efforts to make this happen tonight. As many of you know, Stuart's work has touched a range of fields from philosophy to politics, geography, to you name it. His work is interdisciplinary in the best sense of the term, demonstrating remarkable ability for philosophical acumen in the best sense, his work is demonstrating acumen touch, see, obviously I can't do acumen, so touch with real world needs for genealogies of concepts critical to our recent milieu, given the supposed war on terrorism, drone warfare, and the implacability, it seems, of the states of sovereignty and territory. He's published 5 books, which I mentioned just to give you an idea of the breadth of his work: Mapping the Present, Heidegger, Foucault, and the Project of the Spatial History, 2001, Understanding Henri Lefebvre, Theory and the Possible, 2004, Speaking Against Number, Heidegger, Language, and the Politics of Calculation, 2006, Terror and Territory, the Spatial Extent of Sovereignty, 2009, as well as The Birth of Territory, out later this year from University of Chicago Press. Each of these works has brought Elden the widest attention in the academy, but I've leaned on them myself in my own humble writings where our projects intersect. But I would pause also to mention this, his heroic, we're probably strong, but you get the point, his work as an editor of the leading journal Geography and Ancillary Disciplines, Society and Space, where I'm co-editor. I receive more emails from Stuart on any given day than perhaps my loved ones. As we editors wade through many hundreds of submissions per year, and Stuart is one of the few top quality researchers that provides such a leading role in serving the Academy, where it's generally the rule that people get Emmy renown and leave this grunt work to others.
Hope he's not doing that soon.
Stuart's work there, as he's often remarked to me, is to make sure people in disciplines outside of philosophy present articles that would have the theoretical acumen, is that word again, we philosophers expect of ourselves, while also performing the in-depth studies of local and global political movements and activities. This fall, Stuart Elvin will move from his long home in geography at Durham University to being professor of political theory and geography at the University of Warwick. There, he will no doubt continue two projects we will see in the coming days. The first is on Shakespearean territories, about which we'll hear more tomorrow at the Peter Easton Pub. And his other project, though, is to do a genealogy of Foucault's 1975 History of Sexuality volume and how this particular work came to be. No doubt, his lecture tonight, entitled Knowledge, Truth, and Power, The Politics of Foucault's Leçons sur la Volonté de Savoir, that is, Lessons on the Will to Know, will give us a taste of that ongoing project. Please join me in welcoming Stuart to the demonstrably geographically central, yet philosophically wild locale of New Zealand.
Thank you very much for that very generous, too generous introduction. And thank you for inviting me to give you this lecture this evening. It is an honour to speak to you. I'm very grateful, and I've enjoyed my time here immensely so far, and I still have some to come, so thank you for that. It's a lecture in the humanities, and yet I've always found myself in social science faculties, and at Durham, one of my roles is the social science director of Durham's Institute of Advanced Study. In that role, I feel something of a fraud because I actually feel much more at home with the humanities than I do with the social sciences. In the work that I've done on history, in the Shakespeare work, on literature, on questions where I sort of dabble in philosophy, all of these as topics of inquiry and modes of analysis mean that I actually feel more at home in terms of humanities than I do in terms of social sciences. And those historical and literary works perhaps connect me best to George Story and Professor Story's own work on questions around language, literature, culture, and history. I'm going to talk about Foucault today, and Peter already gave you some indication of what this project sits in relation to some wider work that I've been doing. Over the past 15 years or so, Foucault's lecture courses at the Collège de France, an institute that he worked in from 1970 until his death in 1984. Foucault's yearly lecture courses have been published, first in French and then in English translation, usually a few years later. And that those lecture courses have really transformed how people who work on Foucault understand his work. If we look at his work, the books that he published in his own lifetime, they're almost like the kind of the mountaintops. And what we're seeing in the lectures are the valleys that fill in the material between, that we could have quite a disconnected sense of Foucault's interests, the things that he was working on, the questions he was concerned with, the methods that he was using of inquiry, if we simply look only at the books, the kind of pinnacles of these peaks that he published in that lifetime. What we've now got is something that I think is not too strong to say is almost a new Foucault, enough new material, new leads, new inquiries, new ways of thinking that Foucault gives us in those lecture courses that we can explore in different ways. We can fill in some of the gaps between his published books, but we can also see some of the openings that he made that he never had time to follow up himself, the dead ends that he went down, the different questions and things he was trying out. In that his lectures at the Collège de France were not standard university lectures, standard university courses where he had students who would take an exam at the end, but they were to report on his ongoing research as he was in the process of doing it. And he didn't have students, but he had auditors, people who came to listen, came to react to the things that he was saying. So we see kind of Foucault alive in these lectures. We see the way that Foucault is engaging with these different kinds of questions. Now, Peter mentioned that I've been working on a project around Foucault and around Foucault's history of sexuality for a while, because the idea that I have is that I can use Foucault's lecture courses, material that's archived in France in various places, and some of the other material that was published in Foucault's lifetime, but maybe in obscure places, in other languages, in minor journals and so on, to use those to try to write really a history of a book, a history of the history of sexuality. Because Foucault embarked on a particular way of thinking about that that he outlined in the first volume, the 1976 introductory volume, that he didn't actually go on and complete. In that, he outlined a thematic volume of how he was going to study things. What he ended up doing was a much more properly historical volume that looks at very different material, both in time and in place. And so Foucault changed his mind. Why Foucault changed his mind, I think we can tell, we can find out from looking at the lecture courses published at the Collège de France. So today, what I'm going to give you is really a kind of a prelude to this book. This is material around what lectures that Foucault is giving in those years at the Collège de France, and here's a list of those lectures, some of which are available in English, some of which are still to come out in English, and the one I'm going to speak about is Foucault's first lecture course, the one that he gave between late 1970 and early 1971, which will be translated and published later this year as Lectures on the Will to Know. But what Foucault does in that lecture course is really sets out an agenda that's going to shape his work over the next 13 or 14 years. Of course, when he gave the opening course, he didn't know how long he'd be doing this material on working on. But I think he sets out ideas in that opening lecture course that continue to exercise him for the rest of his career there. Now, Foucault's inaugural lecture, rather than the inaugural lecture course, was given on the 2nd of December 1970 and has been translated for a long time, and it's called The Order of Discourse. Foucault gave the first lecture of this course, the Lessons on the Will to Know, the following week, and they form very much an integrated inquiry. Foucault is setting out in that inaugural lecture through to his first course what he's going to be working on over that coming year. So the inaugural lecture is part of the material, but unfortunately doesn't appear in the book, so that the book, the Lectures on the Will to Know, already is less than what Foucault delivered in that first year at the college. So it's already lacking something that I see as crucial material to it. And it's also less than what Foucault actually said in his lectures that year, because this course is based on the manuscript that Foucault left behind. Foucault's partner, Daniel Defer, inherited all of Foucault's papers after Foucault died and has served as the editor of this volume. He's made the use of the manuscript rather than tape recordings. There are no extant tape recordings of that course available. The problem is the manuscript isn't in a complete state. There's pages that are missing either in part or in whole, and it appears that Foucault took all of the material on Nietzsche in this course out in order to use it as the basis for a lecture somewhere else, and that has not been preserved, and so there's a big hole in the middle of this course that isn't filled with archived material that's available. And yet, they have actually supplemented this with material that Foucault didn't give in that course at the Collège de France. So there's already more material in this course than Foucault actually delivered between December and March in that academic year. They filled it in with some lectures that he gave on Nietzsche that are close enough, they think, to the material he would have given in France, and they've supplemented it with manuscript on Oedipus. I may come back to that later. A manuscript on Oedipus that Foucault added into the file where these materials were kept. So that the title of the course, the Lectures on, or the Lessons on, the Will to Know, actually makes sense. These are thematically linked materials to what Foucault gave at the college that year, rather than exactly the words that he said, as the other courses have been. The other courses have been transcriptions of the tape recordings that were left behind in the archive of the Collège de France. This one, they don't have the tape recording, so they've had to just use the manuscript for that basis. So Foucault is lecturing on this material. He's outlining his material as a research professor, somebody talking about the questions that he's interested in, setting out an agenda that he's going to follow for his work over the next few years. Now, if we follow the standard story about Foucault, the one that you get in the introductory textbooks, the one that has been passed down since the early 1980s to how we should make sense of Foucault's career, this is something like the standard story that we get. Foucault in the 1960s is concerned with the question of knowledge. He works with an analytical tool called archaeology to investigate questions of knowledge. In the 1970s, Foucault shifts away from that to a concentration on the question of power, and he uses the genealogical method in order to interrogate that way of thinking about things. In the late 1970s, he turns to what he calls governmentality, the kind of rationality and practices of how government actually operates. And in the 1980s, he shifts to questions around ethics and practices of the self, particularly in Greek thought. And that this is seen as a real shift in Foucault, sometimes called the late or the last Foucault, when he turns to investigate ancient Greece. So Alan Sheridan's 1980 book, The Will to Truth, with its two parts, the archaeology of knowledge and the genealogy of power, really set out that sort of two-part way of seeing Foucault's career in the 60s and in the 70s. Very important book that came out in the year that Foucault died, Michel Foucault, Beyond Structuralism and Hermeneutics by Hubert Dreyfus and Paul Rabinow, also cemented that kind of way of reading Foucault, these periods of Foucault's work that move from one to the other over time. The thematic arrangement of how the English collected edition has gone, which has its separate volumes on ethics, aesthetics, and power, that thematic treatment in those volumes, rather than the way that the French version does, which is a chronological one of arranging the text in chronological sequence. The English version, with that thematic division of the volumes, I think that too has cemented this idea there are discrete thematic interests in Foucault's work at different periods of time. This course, my suggestion is, completely destroys that standard chronology, the way that we have understood Foucault. It challenges the way that we have understood Foucault as moving through these different discrete periods with different areas of interest, different modes of analysis, different questions and source material that he was drawing on. Foucault, I think, in this lecture course, shows that he's interested in a whole range of questions which he takes different perspectives on at different times, but really as sort of different angles on the same kinds of questions. To take a different look at material, but it shows thematically, methodologically, topic material, Foucault has got a much more continuous way of thinking about his work than the standard way that we have understood. I think these lecture courses as a whole, and certainly this French DAE, the writings and sayings, or the talks and short essays that are collected in that major work in French, much shorter in the English version. I think that too had complicated this story. This course, it seems to me, is the kind of final nail in the coffin of that standard way of thinking about Foucault's work. Because it comes from 1970-1971, so at the turn between the 60s and the 1970s, but it develops themes of power very definitely alongside questions of knowledge, rather than one replacing the other. And instead of proposing a genealogy as the method to investigate these questions, puts the two together, a genealogy of knowledge alongside an archaeology of knowledge. And as the editor puts it, archaeology as method and Foucault's earlier work, particularly The Order of Things, are clearly propedeutics to genealogy. Genealogy, as it's presented by Foucault, is not a crisis in the archaeological method, but rather it is mutually supportive. The two parts go together in Foucault's work of this period. The course also proposes a genealogy of the ethic of truth, which is a term that most people seem to think was only Foucault of the much later period. And it spends considerable time addressing the relation between truth and subjectivity, particularly in the reading of Oedipus. So as well as anticipating Foucault's work of the early 1970s, up to the book Discipline and Punish, probably Foucault's best-known book from 1975, this course also anticipates a whole range of things that Foucault will work on in the late 1970s and through into the 1980s. It's not simply then a course that introduces a sequence of courses that will go through theories and penal institutions, the punitive society, and then courses we already have in English, psychiatric power, abnormal, society must be defended. It doesn't simply introduce those courses in Foucault's work, but it also opens up a range of questions that will occupy Foucault in the later 1970s. There's a lot of work in here about practices of government. There's material in here on the institution of money. There's material in here about agriculture as a political problem. But its other key thing, the real surprise for me, the vast majority of the course is on ancient Greece. There's an enormous amount of material in here which shows that Foucault in the early 1970s is very familiar with Greek texts, he's very familiar with these as questions, and he uses Greek texts and Greek material to work through these questions. The standard way of reading Foucault had suggested Foucault only turns to ancient thought in the 1980s. This, I think, profoundly disrupts that standard chronology. So there's not, on my reading at least, the radical breaks in Foucault's work that people have standardly attributed to him. There's much more of a continuity of these kinds of questions that he's working on. The very first few minutes of the first lecture of the course, Foucault notes that the theme of the will to know, the wish to, or the desire to know something, could also be characteristic of many of the studies that he'd made in the 1960s up until this point. So it's a slightly kind of retrospective way of looking back at his previous work and trying to make sense of it. And he says it certainly pertains to what he intends to do over the coming years. All of these analyses, both in the past and, he says, yet to come, can be understood as fragments from morphology of the will to know. But let me spend a little moment talking about the title of this course, because I think Will to Know is a legitimate translation of the title, but it's not the only one that was perhaps possible there. The phrase "the will to know" invokes Nietzsche. This is clearly the thing that Foucault is interested in invoking here. Nietzsche and the will to power, or in German, der Wille zur Macht. And this is a notion that in standard French translation became translated as la volonté de puissance. Foucault standardly understands it and translates it as la volonté de pouvoir. What's the difference between puissance and pouvoir? Well, you could kind of do a doctorate studying that relation between those two terms. But what Foucault's interested in that is that puissance is characterized more by kind of power as force, whereas what he's interested in pouvoir is more creative capacity type of power. Power as a pouvoir as a verb also means to be able to do something, to be enabled to do something there. So that's one complication there about that term and what Foucault is doing with this notion. The second complication is this notion of volonté there. Foucault notes that there's a relation between volonté and desire, and what is the relation between those two terms. And he knows that this is an interesting notion, and it can relate, his volonté de savoir can relate to a désir de connaître. Now that invokes the third complication in this. There are two standard French words for knowledge. Foucault is using one of them here, and he separates that out from the other way of thinking about knowledge in some of his earlier work. Particularly in the book The Archaeology of Knowledge, he'd made a distinction between savoir and connaissance. What's the distinction between these? Well, crudely put, savoir is the basic system within which any instance of knowledge can be situated. So think about it, a particular move that you might make of a chess piece compared to the rules of the game of chess as a whole. That might be one way to think about that relation between the terms. So Foucault here is talking about savoir as this kind of overarching sort of structure of knowledge rather than the individual instances of that notion. And Foucault is critical of what he sees as the problems of epistemology of addressing those kinds of questions. He wants to think about this will to knowledge as a much more political question rather than a dry historical epistemological kind of investigation of that question. And the other thing to say here is savoir, like pouvoir, is also a verb as well as a substantive. It means to know as well as knowledge. And so this is why it can be translated, as Graham Birchall has done for this, as lectures on the will to know rather than lectures on the will to knowledge. I think either of them would have been semantically allowable given the French of that. What does Foucault do in the course when he actually gets going, or when I actually get going to talk about what Foucault says in the course? Well, there's a lot of stuff on Aristotle. There's some work on the Sophists. He's interested in Nietzsche, and there's that whole lecture that I said was missing on Nietzsche, but I'll come back to that and fill in from the other material that's added in there later. He's interested in the relations between power and knowledge that you find in sophistry in ancient thought. He's interested particularly in the role of the judiciary in ancient Greece. He's interested in a number of classical texts. There's a short reading of Homer's Iliad, for example. He talks about justice and injustice in Greek thought and Greek practice. He talks about tyranny. He talks about money. He mentions Oedipus at several points in the course, and then there's a whole manuscript devoted to Oedipus later on. A lot, as I said, about the question of money, of economy, of politics, of the law, a whole range of political practices in Greek thought, very different from the Foucault of the 1980s when he's interested in the Greeks. So he's looking to develop a whole range of these themes as different ways of thinking about this relation between, in my title for today's talk, knowledge, truth and power. How do these themes relate, and how can he, by reading these Greek materials, talk about these kinds of questions, raise these kinds of questions or examinations? Why is he interested in Oedipus? Well, one of the reasons he's interested in Oedipus is not perhaps what you might expect. It's not because of what Freud made of the Oedipus story and the question of sex in that story. No, Foucault is much more interested in that story because of the question of what happens when you suddenly discover something, when you know something, and that changes the whole way that you think about yourself. In a sense, the relation between knowledge and subjectivity. He says, the power of Oedipus, he says, is linked to a knowledge. What is this knowledge linked to the conquest and exercise of power? And that what is at play in Oedipus, the play by Sophocles, is the struggle of knowledges and powers, a struggle between forms of power knowledge. And that may well be the first place in any of Foucault's writings where he uses that linked phrase of power knowledge that becomes so important, certainly in the ways that people picked up and used Foucault's work there. So there's clearly a number of themes going on in the course, and I'm not going to try and cover them all, instead concentrating on the question of politics, power and practices. Because a key concern here is not so much knowledge as truth, but in a contested political sense. Because the power-knowledge relation anticipated in the Order of Discourse inaugural lecture is really beginning to be worked through here, perhaps though without the precision of terminology that would later be employed. In a sense, this text makes possible discipline and punish, but without the overlap of material. The three themes then I want to say a little bit more about: knowledge and power and the relation that these have to the practices of archaeology and genealogy. Secondly, the role of Nietzsche, and thirdly, juridical and political practices. Foucault in the course very quickly moves from a focus on knowledge to use the word or the phrase, the will to truth. And the key themes of the course, he suggests, are going to revolve around the relation between three terms: savoir, one type of knowledge, vérité or truth, and the other form of knowledge of connaissance, or perhaps even understanding here. And he's going to talk about these and the relations that they have between these. And he says that over future courses, he's going to turn to the 16th and 17th century, but in this course, he's going to concentrate largely on ancient Greece. How can we think about these questions? He says, if finally we can articulate this will to know, which takes the form of a will to truth, not focused on a subject or an anonymous force, but on real, actual systems of domination. How do these questions relate to political or power relation type questions? Truth, he says, has been historically linked to the exercise of sovereignty or a particular kind of power of ruling over people. And it differs under different systems. And he starts to unpack some different ways in Greek thought that these systems might have been understood and how these would have implications for how we understand what is truth at any given moment of time. He says that it's within this system, this pre-constituted space of sovereignty, that truth is designated, formulated, and proved. It's that the system, the power relations, start to dictate what is taken to be true at particular moments of time, what becomes known as something we can understand as knowledge. The problem, he says, is now of analysing the transformation of truth system to judicial decision to political sovereignty. And Foucault then goes into one of his many digressions in this course where he says, well, actually, you could do something really quite interesting here about how you could write an entire history of the relation between truth and torture. And he talks about this in relation, the French word he uses is le supplice rather than le torture. Now, le supplice is the term he uses at the beginning of Discipline and Punish when he's talking about the spectacular form of public execution or sort of trial in a very public sense about how somebody... In Discipline and Punish, the example is somebody who tried to kill the French king, about how they're put on trial in public, how spectacular acts are acted out on their bodies. Foucault's interested in that kind of display of power, particularly as it's directed towards the body, and how this relates to the question of truth. In this course, he gives examples of people being thrown off the cliff into the sea to see if they float, children exposed to the elements, the killing of slaves, and so on. He gives very brief examples, and this is really kind of like a promissory note for what he might do at some later point, talking about the Inquisition, talking about masochism, and so on. And even here, even in this very early course, the question of confession is seemingly on his mind. Now, I might say something about confession here. Confession, for me, is the key to Foucault's whole history of sexuality. In the initial thematic version of The History of Sexuality, the second volume was going to be on the question of confession. Confession in the church is a particular way of confessing to a person in a position of power the truth about your sexual behaviour, particularly. Foucault doesn't write that volume, or at least he starts writing that volume and stops, abandons it, goes into the very different historical form that The History of Sexuality takes. And The History of Sexuality, as he was working on in his final years, the fourth volume was again going to be on confession, but it was going to be on a different historical period. Instead of the 16th, 17th century, which is what his initial volume on confession was going to be focused on, he moves to a focus on the early church fathers, and a question of confession. Now, neither of those volumes are available, but both of them seem to be filling crucial parts in Foucault's history of sexuality. But it seems to me that even in the early 1970s, Foucault is already interested in this question of confession, particularly because of this relation between truth and power. Foucault talks about some different structures of knowledge that he thinks are interesting or important that he wants to understand in detail, saying that these are models that come largely from the East but start to organise Greek and Western knowledge more generally. First of which is knowledge of the origin, of genesis, of succession, of cosmology, of philosophy and history. Second one is a kind of more calculative, quantitative form, quantities, sums, measures, mathematical knowledge, physical knowledge. And the third one is one that might be slightly more disruptive to some of those ways of thinking, the event, the occasion, the moment, and then technical knowledge is particular kind of forms of applied knowledge of how these turn into practice. And he talks about how the first two of these are very central in shaping the way that the West begins to think about these questions of origin and measure, succession and quantity, temporal and numerical order. But he says that the last has a slightly different trajectory, a more disruptive trajectory, but is that this, particularly this knowledge in this form, is pushed more and more to the margins, that it's pushed away as magic, as sorcery, as some kind of seditious form of knowledge that gets pushed out of the way, perhaps only to re-emerge at some later political point. Now, I've suggested that Foucault's interest in Greek thought is profound here. This passage here, where he's talking about the relation between political power and the state apparatus, about how knowledge is naturally located, he says, in the hands of functionaries. Knowledge is a state service and a political instrument. It follows that its character is necessarily secret. It cannot neither circulate nor spread. It is linked directly to the possession of power. That kind of passage, if we'd read it and we didn't know where in Foucault's work this passage had appeared, we would think this is the kind of way that Foucault is talking about the exercise of sovereignty within medieval and early modern Europe. This is actually a description in this course of how ancient Greek thought was thinking about these kinds of questions. It's a very modern set of terms that he's using to describe that classical Greek thought. He's actually, with that passage, describing archaic period of Greek thought between 800 and 480 BCE. What's interesting, it seems to me here, is not that Foucault is using a modern set of terminology to understand Greek thought, but that the terminology he develops to think about the question of power initially comes out of his reading of Greek thought. This is where Foucault forges the kind of conceptual tools, the conceptual apparatus he would then later use to examine very different historical periods. Foucault's first use of this kind of vocabulary is in his work on ancient Greek thought. That, for me, was a huge surprise. That, I think, transforms some of the ways we think about how Foucault's work is situated, how there's a chronology of areas of interest and so on in his writing. But he says there's a transformation in Greek thought, and it's that transformation that he's interested in examining in this work. So he says there's going to be this transformation where knowledge is going to be disassociated from the state apparatus and the direct exercise of power. It must be detached from political sovereignty in its immediate application and become the correlate of justice, of dikaion, or truth-giving, or justice-giving, as a natural divine and human order. This, as a transformation, is again what we would ordinarily link to Foucault's way of saying that power relations are not understood through the body of the king, the centralized political authority within a society, but need to be decentered, and we need to understand power relations suffused throughout society. But again, this is a description of a later period of Greek thought. Foucault's talking about these in a range of ways of opening up these kinds of questions about how these issues are explored in different ways in Greek thought. Then I'm suggesting that later he uses very, very similar formulations to make sense of a much more modern period of our history. The key point, then, I'm trying to make here, Foucault's well-known analysis of power, the way that he thinks that we have a standard way of understanding power in the late medieval through to the early modern period, that then our modern way of understanding power needs to be differentiated from, the way that we need to have these two different models of power, centred in the king, a centralised, top-down, hierarchical model of power, replaced by this power suffused through the social body, power at all levels and in all directions. We standardly in Foucault date that as a shift that happens around the 16th, 17th century. In this course, Foucault is making, I think, almost exactly the same analysis, but he's making it of ancient Greece. That, I think, really changes the way that we think about these questions in Foucault's work. So that Foucault's analysis of power develops out initially of his reading of the Greeks. But it also comes from his engagement with Nietzsche. And the supplementary lecture on Nietzsche treats the question of how we can use Nietzsche to trace the history of truth. Foucault begins with a fairly famous passage from one of Nietzsche's unpublished manuscripts from early in his life, where Nietzsche is talking about the invention of knowledge. This is this kind of fable that on some far-flung planet surrounding an obscure star, for a very short moment, there were these clever animals that discovered the notion of truth. Those clever animals are us, they're humans. And Nietzsche's little fable in this story, Foucault picks up on here, because he says what's interesting here is the way that Nietzsche talks about the invention of knowledge. Not the discovery of knowledge, but the invention of knowledge. And that Foucault talks about this not as an origin, again a question that will come up in Foucault elsewhere, but as and not as simply something like a beginning, but as some kind of form of invention, some form of creation out of this. So he suggests, Foucault suggests, that knowledge doesn't have an origin, but it does have a history. That truth is also an invention, but of a later date, where subject-object is a product of knowledge rather than the foundation of knowledge, where illusion, error, and lie are categories of what he calls non-true truth. This is more trying to think about this as a kind of a system of truth within which certain things might be adjudicated as being true or false. So he's talking about this in terms of how knowledge then is linked to a history, but also linked to the question of power. Knowledge, he says, is based on a network of relations, different in their form. It may be destruction, appropriation, punishment, domination, different in their points of support, their kind of groundings, and the terms to which they are put in relation, body to body, group to group, individual to a thing, animal or God. The basis of knowledge is thus the play of differences. It's out of this struggle and structures that these things that we call knowledge emerge. And a nice line where he's having a bit of a swipe against certain other forms of philosophy going on at the time, against the warm softness of a phenomenon, we must develop the murderous tenacity of knowledge. It's a kind of nice phrase of what he's trying to think about this in these terms. So Foucault is clearly opposing one view of the history of philosophy to the one that Nietzsche allows him to start to develop and to work through. The Nietzsche material, I think, is very interesting. I think there's more to be done with this material in terms of the kind of questions around how we think about these ideas. And that Foucault is interested in Nietzsche, this has been known for a long time, that Foucault was interested in Nietzsche, particularly from the 1950s onwards. But which Nietzsche has always been a question that has been somewhat on people's minds. Foucault had suggested it wasn't the Nietzsche of Thus Spoke Zarathustra that he was more interested in, but more the Nietzsche of the genealogies, the Nietzsche of the histories, and so on. But what's interesting in this course is it seems to confirm the suspicion that some people have had for a while, that actually it's The Birth of Tragedy that is favourite book of Nietzsche rather than the genealogy of morality. The Birth of Tragedy and some of the questions that are being raised in there are something that motivates Foucault in his own investigations here. And we could go back to one of the few pieces that Foucault did publish on Nietzsche in his own lifetime, the Nietzsche Genealogy History lecture. And in the light of this course, we can reread the last lines of that piece on Nietzsche Genealogy History, where Foucault notes the critical modality of history is metamorphosized within genealogy. The critique of past injustices by the truth held by man today becomes the destruction of the subject of connaissance, of knowledge, by the injustice proper to the will to knowledge, to savoir. And I think the existing English translation really mangles the sense of that, but in the light of this course, I think we can understand a bit better what Foucault is talking about here. Let me turn then to the judicial and political practices and try and link these to what Foucault was doing in terms of his own political practice at the time he was giving these lectures. Foucault's interested in quite a wide range of political things going on in ancient Greece at the time, including the management of agrarian crises between the 7th and the 6th century, particularly what is done with the fragmentation of land and the legacy of colonization in Greek thought. What happens with the armies that are gaining all of this land on behalf of Greek states? How do they distribute that land to those soldiers as recompense for it? In terms of the development of new forms of resource extraction, particularly iron, warfare between cities, the emergence of the artisan class within Greek society, slavery, urban civilization, changes in production, and so on. Many of the sorts of themes Foucault will look at in the work on governmentality of the late 1970s, but again in a different historical and geographical setting. Foucault talks about three key developments that he's interested in terms of the Greek thought he's examining at this point. The institution of money, and not simply as a measure of exchange, but something that's instituted essentially as an instrument of distribution, allocation, and of social correction. Being British and having seen the budget yesterday, there might be something in that today. The second one, the institution of nomos, or the written form of law, which is not simply political constitution, but the very discourse of social order. And finally, the institution of justice on a religious model. And he talks about how these notions of measure relate to notions of calculation, so it might be in terms of economic practices, but also in terms of measure as a norm against which behaviour is set and measured against that. Foucault then is interested in these sets of questions, very political questions, but in the Greek thought about how you can trace instances of knowledge or of truth to these political power relations and so on. And he starts to again go off in different digressions around these ideas, but these link to a range of other things we know from other lecture courses and Foucault's books published in his lifetime, when he talks about the relation between the pure and the impure, and how some of these different institutions can be used to regularise and order those kinds of relations, about this in terms of criminality and innocence, or ignorance and knowledge. So in terms of perhaps the prison and the school, two institutions Foucault would talk about later on in his life. He talks about how impurity must be expelled from the space of the nomos through mechanisms such as partition, separation and non-mixing, the law saying that one must exclude. And you can see there both what Foucault does in many of his writings about what happens to mad people, to diseased people, to sexual deviants, so-called, within societies, to criminals and so on, the spatial partitions that take place in terms of the exclusion and inclusion of people within society, and also a beginning of a claim that I've made a lot of in my other writing about how Foucault says that discipline is above all an analysis of space. How do you understand how space is ordered and organised in relation to these political practices and so on? And there's also the beginning of what looks a little bit like a link that I'm sure in time people will start to mine extensively, of where Foucault is maybe beginning to anticipate what Giorgio Agamben does with the Zoe Bios distinction, the distinction between two forms of life that Agamben finds in Greek thought and uses as the foundation for his writings around the notion of homosaka and so on. It seems one of the notes in this course indicates that in an as yet unpublished lecture course from the early 1980s, Foucault discusses that distinction in some detail. It's entirely possible that Agamben was an auditor in that lecture course, and that may well be a link there between those thinkers. There's also the notion that Foucault develops around the idea of what he calls popular power, the negative side or the reverse side to what is instituted by the philosophers or the lawgivers in terms of structuring Greek society. The power, he says, of popular power is the opposite of the nomos because it's changeable, it's likely to be swayed by speech, discussion, the vote, and changeable will. It's excluded from political knowledge and knowledge of things. Popular power only listens to its interests and its desires. It's violent. It imposes its will on all. Its popular power is a murderer. And Foucault notes that popular power can also be the murderer of people. It can be the murder of the wise man. And the example that he gives in the lecture as it was actually delivered, rather than in the manuscript, is of course Socrates. Popular power, Foucault says, is criminal in its essence, criminal in its relation to the nomos, the fundamental law of the existence of the city. Popular power is a crime against the very nature of the city. Now, Foucault's giving this lecture course in early 1971, and it would be wrong to read this simply as Foucault as the person standing up and giving lectures every week to the people that came to hear him at the Collège de France. At the time, Foucault was heavily involved in political movements within France, and the one that he was particularly involved in at this time was a group called the Group for Information on Prisons. And that Foucault was actually delivering material on behalf of that group in the very same weeks that he was giving lectures on this course. So even though this course is about ancient Greece, Foucault is involved in prison protest groups in France at the time that he is writing. And this group, which was set up by Foucault and by a number of other French thinkers, two of the figures there, Jean-Paul Sartre and Gilles Deleuze, were both involved with the group at different points in its existence. But what's interesting about the group is the language that's used about the group by them in their public pronouncements, in their manifestos and so on. The group, they say, has a task of making the prison known, faire savoir la prison. And that the group, a circular letter was initially sent round by Foucault and other people to prisoners and families of prisoners in January 1971, the very time he's delivering this course, asking them to give them information about prisons. They're not saying that they already know what's going on in prisons and they want to change it. They're saying we actually don't know what's going on in prisons. And the role of this group, the Group for Information on Prisons, was actually to find this material out, to document it and to make it more widely available. And Foucault, in the note that was sent round to prisoners and was handed out outside of prisons to families that were going in to visit prisoners in France, was saying that all of this material should be sent to Foucault at his home address so that he could start to catalogue this material. And on the 8th of February, right in the middle again of this course, Foucault gave a press conference where he read the manifesto of the group. It was at the end of a hunger strike for prisoners, and he read the manifesto. So what I'm suggesting here is the political activism right alongside the lecture courses, because I think very similar themes are going on in this material. What do they say in that manifesto? None of us is sure to escape prison, today less than ever. We are told that prisons are overpopulated, but what if it was that the population was being over-imprisoned? I mean, you only have to look just south of the border here to see whether that term actually may be true today. And he talks about little information is published on prisons. It's one of the hidden regions of our social system, one of the black boxes of our life. Key line here, if you read this in the context of this lecture course, we have the right to know, we want to know. This is why, with magistrates, lawyers, journalists, doctors, psychologists, we have formed a group for information on prisons. We propose to make known what the prison is, to tell people what is going on in there, and all of the different systems and regulations that go on within the prison, things that Foucault historically will examine in Discipline and Punish, but is interested in the very present moment at that particular time. The sort of the modesty of what this group is trying to do that you find in that suggestion, it is not for us to suggest reform. We only wish to know the reality. That's what the group was founded for. That's what the group was involved with trying to do. Now, the group got itself into all sorts of problems, obviously, with the French state for this. They were linked to several left-wing journals. The French state tried to ban some of those journals. The Maoist Gauche Proletarienne journal was made illegal, at which point Jean-Paul Sartre declared that he was the editor, effectively daring the state to arrest him, and that he, Simone de Beauvoir, and Jean-Luc Godard, the film director, began to sell it publicly in the street, particularly near prisons. And Sartre's own journal, J'accuse, named after Emile Zola's letter in the Dreyfus Affair nearly a century before, had already published material from this group, and that Daniel Defer, Foucault's partner and the editor of this lecture course I've been talking about, had written a piece which said, when information itself is a struggle, it's the knowledge is a form of power relation, it's a form of thinking about these questions. So in short, Foucault and his colleagues, they had a will to know what was going on in the prison. It was a very political act, but exactly at the same time he's delivering these lectures on ancient Greece. Now, reading this course as what Foucault elsewhere calls a history of the present, I think is no more seen in the way that Foucault understands the shifting Greek thought from the period of Solon to the later period. He says in the old system that it's done away with, there is the same distribution of wealth and power where these two are very closely linked together. With Solon and Solon's reforms within Greece, if someone takes too much power, they are punished by the city. If they take too much wealth, they must await the punishment of Zeus. And Foucault notes that the status of rich and poor is outside of the legal code, the eunomia that Solon puts forward. It's to do with things that are somehow external from politics, luck, chance, or fate. It's the will of the gods. But what he's interested in is what happens after this period, of the break from that earlier way of thinking about these questions to a different Greek way of thinking about those kinds of relations. So he says, out of these changes appears an absolutely novel notion. The city-state, the polis, a grouping of citizens as holders of a share of power, and that power as a whole exercised through them all. So he says there's a contrast between an earlier model of power, of sovereign power, concentrated through the instituted law as a principle of distribution, value, and wisdom, the order which makes it possible to rule over men and to rule over other things that are going on within that political community. But then there's a break and there's something different that starts to emerge from this. It's there, he says, can be mapped the place of a knowing and neutral subject, the form of an unveiled truth and the content of a knowledge which is no longer magically linked to the repetition of an event, but the discovery and maintenance of an order. And that passage really links concerns that run throughout Foucault's entire career, from the 1960s to the 1980s, around those kinds of issues. What does Foucault say emerges in this new way of understanding Greek thought? Power, he says, it's no longer exclusively held by someone. It's no longer concentrated in a single individual. It's no longer unilaterally endured by others. So it's not you have power exercised over you. And it's no longer something that's instituted or exercised through ritual, gestures, words, commands, or instances. That's the older form of power. We're moving to some different, more modern type of power. It's not now a top-down model of domination, power that is concentrated in a single source, exercised over those who don't have it. It's not focused in spectacular bursts or displays of power, but rather it operates in the way that Foucault will later describe as the microphysics of power, of small actions, of continual operations. What does Foucault say? This is still on Greek thought. Power is that which is permanently exercised across all of the citizens. The entirety of a social body begins to emerge as the place where power is applied. Power is born from a body over which it is exercised. Now, Foucault uses exactly that same break in his later writings to talk about a very different historical period, the period, as I've suggested, of the break in the early modern European model. He's using that very same language, very same distinctions around how power is understood in the previous system to a later system to examine a period of time which is, what, about 2,000 years afterwards. But the vocabulary that is emerging in his analysis of the Greeks is exactly the same kind of vocabulary that he later uses to talk about that later historical period. This is my key point. Foucault's analysis of power develops out of his work on knowledge. It's theoretically enriched by his engagement with Nietzsche and is born out of his reading of the Greeks. And it's that reading that this course makes possible that seems to me to profoundly challenge some of the standard ways that we have understood Foucault, that we have been taught Foucault, that we think about what's going on within Foucault's work. And just as Foucault himself was critical of ways of thinking about history in terms of blocks that transform into different blocks, but was actually interested in what were the minute changes that took place between them to make possible the transition in systems of knowledge, I think these lecture courses allow us to do something similar with the way that we read Foucault and that we think about those questions in his work. Thank you.